Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 25th, 2014. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Denny Kahn and Drew Beecham talk about experimental home brewing and the book they've written of the same name. It's the book that covers both standard and wacky techniques and invites you to play along online. If you're new to home brewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We also have a show page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on the Google Plus every now and then, too. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Especially important this time of year when you think about Christmas shopping. It's just around the corner. Whenever you think of shopping on Amazon, go to our website first, basicbrewing.com. Click on our Amazon link on the right-hand side of the page. And then whatever you buy on Amazon after that, we'll get a chunk of. You won't notice any difference, but we will, and we certainly do. Thank you very much. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well that work in a similar fashion. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows app, too, Windows phone app, that is. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We're just everywhere. We are ubiquitous. Check out our Brewer's Logbook at basicbrewingshop.com. In the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews. And there is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who's done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com. And finally, for a limited time, you can get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with the purchase of any of our DVD combos. Well, as promised last week, I posted a new episode of Basic Brewing video on Friday featuring my version of a Scotch ale, which was very tasty, by the way, and our friend Ed Nicholson's incredible habanero hot sauce. In the video, you'll see that Ed shows one of his Carolina Reaper peppers, which is supposed to be one of the hottest varieties in the world. They say it's around 1.5 million Scoville units. To give you a comparison, a habanero, Ed says, is around 200,000 Scoville units. Now, what we didn't show on that episode was that after we turned off the camera, we each tried a tiny chunk of the Carolina Reaper pepper. It's about the half the size of my pinky fingernail, but the effect was amazing. There was about a five-second delay where we could actually taste the pepper itself. It has a sweet taste, but then there's like an explosion of heat that coated our tongues and mouths, and I've never eaten anything that had such an I guess you could say an autonomic response, because I started sweating, my head felt hot, and the effects lasted for a fairly long time for such a little bitty piece of pepper. I can't imagine eating a whole one, and I've seen videos of people on YouTube doing that, and they usually don't have the pepper in them for very long. But I do want to use one of those Carolina Reapers, or at least a little chunk of one, in a beer recipe somehow someday. But it will certainly be a trick to make it drinkable and not painful. So any hints would be appreciated. If you've brewed any kind of beer with one of these super hot peppers and not come out with just an unbearably hot beer, let me know. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Chris from Cleveland writes after seeing that video, the Basic Brewing video episode. Chris says, I enjoyed watching you have a love affair with your Scotch ale. Since it may be a while till I get to brew mine, I figured I'd tell you how you can use my dry figging technique to create your own fresh fig Scottish ale. If you have any Scotch ale remaining, make sure it's at ambient temperature. Then simply add one or two fig leaves to the beer in either the keg or the fermenter. Chris says, I like to leave the leaves exposed to the air after they're picked a bit to allow the aromatics to develop. Give them a quick dip in star sand and place them into the beer. He says you'll start to pick up the flavor in just a few hours. You'll crave this beer anytime the words Scotch Ale are mentioned. By the way, I call mine Friggin' Mac Figgin. Well, that sounds like fun. We have a giant fig tree in the yard that produces excellent figs, and I haven't eaten the leaves yet, though, so that might be a fun thing to do. Jim from Herndon, Virginia writes, after hearing this past week's show with Jeff Muse and his experiment with our shortened 15-minute boil experiment using extract, Jim says, awesome to hear that validation of the process. I've done it a few times now since seeing your article last year to try out different hops. I've recently converted a Russian River Row 2 Hill 56 recipe to a 15-minute extract version using a blend of dry for the Pilsner and liquid for the Maris Otter. It was a huge hit, and I made the kit for a buddy to give it a whirl as well. Jim says, I especially like the point about people not giving him a hard time because it's extract. I'm normally a 10-gallon all-grain brewer, but find this method a lot of fun. Excellent. Thanks, Jim. That Russian River clone does sound like fun, especially if you're only boiling for 15 minutes. We have a sponsor this week. Just like your favorite beer and cheese pairing, the American Homebrewers Association is the perfect companion for anyone who's passionate about beer. Whether you're an expert home brewer or just getting started, more than 43,000 members rely on the AHA for money-saving member deals, event discounts, and brewing resources. As a not-for-profit organization, the AHA relies on members to support their work to promote, protect, and grow the homebrewing craft. Support your passion. Visit homebrewersassociation.org and join today. Very nice. We're all members here. Let's get to the interview. If you listen to this program, you know how we love experiments. Well, Denny Kahn and Drew Beecham like them too. And they've written a book called Experimental Home Brewing: Mad Science in the Pursuit of Great Beer. Well, Denny Kahn, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Always a pleasure, James.
And Drew Beecham, your first timer here on the show. Welcome.
Woo!
Woo indeed.
You guys have come out with yet another homebrew book. Is that what you're hearing from people, or do you get any skeptics out there saying, you know, what new have you brought to the table that nobody else has done?
Yeah, dude, what? I need to read another book.
I think, you know, I really think that people who know anything about Drew and me expect that this book will be as unusual as it is.
I think that's one way of saying wacky.
Yeah. Let's face it, I don't think that there's ever been a homebrew book like this. I mean, as a matter of fact, the little review that John Palmer gave us, it's on the back cover, says authoritative yet whimsical. that's not a bad way to look at it.
Yeah, now, the real question is, who's the authority and who's whimsical?
Yeah, well, people can decide for themselves. We like to tell people it's like if Click and Clack from Car Talk went out for beers with Mr. Wizard. This is the kind of conversation that would ensue. And actually, in the book, there's a lot of back and forth between Drew and me.
Yeah, I
want to translate that for the younger homebrewers who are out there. You may not know Mr. Wizard, but think Bill Nye the Science Guy.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, I noticed that that you guys have footnotes. You know, one of you will write a section of the book, and the other will have like a, well, I don't do it that way, but here's a, so there's like a little rebuttal at the end of some of the
You know, we were extremely fortunate to have an editor who would let us get away with that and leave it in there. But part of that is the whole theory of the book, that there's not a single correct way to homebrew, and it's what works for you, and you need to try things and find out what that is.
Yeah, I mean, I always joke that if you stick five homebrewers in a room, you'll come up with nine ways to brew something, and seven
That's
of them will
right.
be right.
That's right.
And so, yeah, it really, part of the point of everything that we're doing here is that it's trying to teach people how to discover what works for you and how to discover what works for you, not from from a sort of a knee-jerk emotional level, but from an actual, like, no, I've sat down and I've really thought this through and I've evaluated this, and this makes sense. One of the things that we notice in a lot of scientific discourse that you find online is you'll have people sit there and go, oh, well, you know, but I just read this study from, you know, the folks over at Anheuser-Busch, and this is what they do, and this is what they found, and, you know, the extraction of XYZ chemicals that are way too long for anybody to actually name unless you're a chemist. And, you know, therefore, this way that we've been doing things is completely wrong, and we need to do it.
Uh-oh.
That sounds like Drew went bye-bye. What he was getting at, though, is what works for some big brewery and some study may not necessarily be applicable in your home brewery. And even what works for another home brewer may not be applicable to you. So the idea should be to collect information and try things and see what does work for you and come up with your own method of doing things. Now, we do take both whack at both sides of the term experimental in this, because besides having the science side, we also have the wild and crazy side with some truly wacky recipes, and some, you know, some straight ahead recipes that we give ideas for how you can wacky up. The publisher, you know, had come to us with an idea for experimental home brewing, kind of something along the lines of radical brewing by Randy Mosier. But I mean, let's face it, you can't out Randy. So, so what we wanted to do then was look at both sides, where you're making experimental beers with experimental ingredients. We have several big sections covering experimental ingredients and how you might want to use them. But then also we have sections on different procedures you might want to try for your beer, and a long section on how to evaluate those procedures objectively. So you're not just saying, darn it, I just spent 8 hours doing a triple decoction. I know this beer has to be better because I did all that work.
Yeah, and that's the thing. People get that emotional attachment. It's got to be better because I did a buttload of work in order to make this happen. And, you know, truthfully, one of the things that I think is true for both Denny and I is we are both extraordinarily lazy people where we can be.
Oh, yeah.
I like to think of it as being optimally efficient.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I call it pragmatic, you know.
There you go. If I don't have to spend, you know, 10 hours doing something, I get just as good as a result. I'm perfectly okay doing things the untraditional, fast way.
Now, you do go into some detail on your individual brewing setups, and you go into a bit of detail on just the basics of brewing. But this is a book. This is the second year of the home brewing course. This is not the buy this book if you want to start from scratch and you've never brewed a batch of beer before, right?
Yeah, this is Brew 201.
Yeah, you know, this is for people who have been brewing long enough so that they have some idea what they want to do, both process-wise and ingredient-wise, and want to figure out where to go and how to decide if that's really working for them.
Yeah,
I mean, with all due respect to Mr. Palmer, who's a dear friend of all of us, I call this book the anti-how to brew, because we don't tell you how to brew. We give you options for ways you can brew and ways to then decide what's working.
Yeah. I also will say that, you know, we say that, you know, again, this is for people who have progressed down their brew career a little bit. If you're a nerdy obsessive type like I am, that means that you pretty much want to pick up this book around batch 5.
Now, one of the biggest hurdles that I faced when I first started brewing was that I was the guy who stuck to the recipe, and you know, as I was in cooking at that same time as well, you know, if the recipe said 1/8 of a teaspoon of salt, then that's what's going to go into the pot, you know, and as far as a cooking recipe. And the same thing with a brewing recipe. If the homebrew store didn't have the kind of hops that were listed in that recipe, well, I moved on to a different recipe that, you know, where they did have all the exact ingredients. And it took me a while to kind of loosen those reins and start designing my own recipes. Chapter 2 is recipe design. And you guys come at it, as you said, you know, you ask every home brewer and they get a different way of doing things. You guys, do you come about it from a radically different point of view?
I think I kind of think it's one of those things where if you talk to like folks who are deep into any subject, you know, they'll have different approaches, but they ultimately get them to the same place. So part of what I wrote up in here is what I affectionately refer to as brewing on the ones. You know, smash beers have been really popular recently. You know, everybody's like, hey, look, you do smash. You can explore things and find out your ingredients and what this hop tastes like and what that grain tastes like. And it's very good from that point of view. But frankly, the beers that are produced are not always the best or the most interesting. And so I kind of started to stop and look at it and say, okay, well, what's really actually appealing about it? And that was the idea of restriction. And so I tend to approach my recipes from a what's the least I can do to get to where I need? Because I did the same thing I think a lot of homebrewers have done over the years where you walk into the brew store, right? You start to develop your recipe and, you know, it's like, oh, I'll have a little of this in there, and I'll have a little of this, and I want some toasty flavor, so I'll put that in there too. And next thing you know, you end up with 8 malts and 5 different varieties of hops, or 10 different varieties of hops. And the beers, I always say, you know, come out tasting like they're brown. They have the flavor of brown. And so what I started to develop as a way to kind of remove part of that impulse was this notion of brewing on the ones, which is, one base malt, one specialty malt, one type of hop, and, you know, see what you can build inside that framework and then add to it as you need. And so that's been my philosophy for a while. And it gets you to that nice, simple, clean, and very laser-like focused kind of place on your bills.
I think whenever I see somebody come into a homebrew shop with an ingredient list as long as your arm, one of the things I think is, well, somebody's been playing with their brewing app on their computer because the color isn't just exactly right. So I'm going to add a tenth of an ounce of this, and then it, you know, moves the bracket down, and okay, now it fits within the style guidelines. So they're not following their instincts; they're following this gadget that's on the machine.
Yeah, but you have to admit that there is something that's really great and fun about wasting your lunch hour sitting in front of the computer going, I am now going to brew in my mind.
That's good. Yeah, and, you know, I'm not really as consciously minimalist as Drew is, but I do feel like every ingredient in a recipe needs to have a reason for being there, needs to justify itself. I kind of start off by getting an overall impression, like doing a tasting in my mind of what I want the finished beer to be. And then I start thinking about ingredients that will get me to that end. In the book, I go through the process of developing my bourbon vanilla porter recipe that a lot of people are familiar with. I'm doing the same thing now. I'm trying to develop what I'm calling an American mild, taking the objectives of flavor and body from an English mild, but applying an American sensibility to it. So I start off by thinking where that beer wants to end up. I put some ingredients together that I think will do that. And then I'm a big believer in brewing more test batches than most people would ever have the patience to do. I think that, I mean, the Myrie IPA recipe took at least a dozen test batches. The bourbon vanilla porter, probably 6 or 8. I'm guessing this American mild is going to probably take me 6 test batches. Starting off by changing one ingredient at a time to see where that goes, but then I find after about 3 batches, you can start making larger alterations because you're getting more of an idea of what works and what doesn't. But like I say, using whatever I feel like I need and as much of it as I feel like I need, but being able to justify it by the end result.
I think Denny doesn't get nearly as bored as I do of the same beer.
No, I don't actually. You know, it's interesting. I can look through my brewing log And it's like when I get, I'm thinking about like getting ready to brew a beer, and I'll look through my brewing log to get the recipe from the last time I brewed that beer, and it's almost exactly a year before, almost always. And it's not conscious planning, it's just I kind of get cravings for these certain beers on a regular basis, and I don't mind having, you know, 12 batches of a 4% American mild around.
Yeah, see, Denny is the one that all the breweries love because, you know, he can keep having that same six pack again and again and again. I'm the dreaded craft beer Nuevo file. I have to have new things.
You know, when I was younger,
when you were younger, dinosaurs were still on the earth.
Yeah, right. And beer came in stone bottles.
Petroleum was still walking.
That's right. Yeah.
So what I want to propose an exercise now. I want to ask each of you to take one of your favorite experimental styles and kind of extrapolate on that. Like start with your base beer and then take us kind of through some variations to show us how you can experiment with one of these base styles to kind of wackify your beers into some differences. Drew, since Denny's talked last, it's like a game show here. There are no prizes, though. But
oh, darn. I'm done.
I might throw some basic brewing swag out there. But Drew, what is one of your favorite experimental styles to start with?
I'm going to shock the nation. Anybody who's ever read any of my stuff will be horrified that I'm about to say this.
Wait! I'm getting a vision here. Does it start with an S?
It does indeed. Yeah. So obviously for me, it's Saison. I've been brewing Saison now. I started brewing beer in 1999, and I think I first started doing Saisons in about 2000, which is like, you know, I like to say I was doing this before you kids. And Saison to me has always just been, you know, one of my favorite playgrounds because it can support so much craziness. As long as you get the base things right. And one of the biggest fundamental failings I see in a lot of people's Saisons, both homemade and commercial made, is that they don't pay attention to the primary tenet of Saison, which is that it has to be dry. You get a lot of people who they'll build like these big weird wacky beers on a Saison base, or what they say is a Saison base, and they end up kind of being a sweet cloying mess. So for me, Saison, get it dry, and that's where you can play. So in the book, I have a recipe I've done probably more than any other recipe I've ever done in my life, and that would be the Saison Experimental. And it's a very simple recipe. 5.5 gallons uses 8 3/4 pounds of Belgian or German Pilsner malt, 1/2 pound of flaked wheat, and 1/2 pound of table sugar. There's just enough hops to bring it up to 22 IBUs on a 1048 beer. And this is like actual classic Saison strength. And then choose your poison. 3711 is great for playing around, I find, with a lot of fruit and hop flavors. White Labs 565, the Belgian Saison 1, or the YEAST 3724, the so-called DuPont strains, are great for building anything that you want have a deep complexity and spiciness to. The other thing I always tell people is, you know, people are like, oh, I don't want to use the DuPont strains because they stall out on you. They'll ferment like gangbusters, and then they'll hang up at like 1020 and hang out there for a while, or 1030. The keys for avoiding that: start cool, pitch a lot of yeast, and most importantly to me, don't use an airlock. Mm. The DuPont strains seem to be incredibly back pressure sensitive. And so ever since I stopped using airlocks on my primary ferments for Saisons, I have never had the dreaded DuPont stall.
Do you cover the mouth of the carboy with anything?
Yeah, sanitized aluminum foil. Denny considers aluminum foil to be sanitary off the roll. I'm a little extra cautious and spray it down with Star Sand.
How hot does an aluminum foil press get, Denny?
Really hot. I mean, my basic, what I'm figuring is that, you know, you wrap your food in it. It's used for food grade stuff all the time. And bottom line is that I've never had a problem not sanitizing it.
It doesn't hurt to spray some Star Sand on there.
If I have Star Sand handy, I do. If I don't, I don't worry about it.
Unless you're like one of the listeners who wrote into me lately and found out that the infections that he was getting in all his beers were stemming from his dirty Star Sand bottle, spray bottle.
No. So yeah, there's that.
Yeah, sanitizers don't work if the sanitizing agent has lost its potency. And I know for a fact that the Star Sand becomes a really good growth medium for a lot of different things if it loses its pH control. So, let's be careful with that.
Yeah, let's just say this. If your Star Sand is green and fuzzy, you should probably replace it.
So, Drew, how would you riff on your Saison, on that base beer?
Well, I can think of two immediately. First one, very kind of modern world, which is a Citra Saison. You know, same idea, that same base beer, add a touch of Munich to it to give it a little bit more oomph, and then take out, normally I do a finishing hop of Zots with my Saison, but instead of doing the Zots, use Citra, and use a nice, big, healthy charge of it. And if you pair that up against the 3711, you get this very kind of slick, dry, mango-pineapple beer, and it's fantastic. And you serve that to people and it makes them go, I didn't expect that. And then the other one, if you've read the Farmhouse Ale books, you know, there's the supposition that the DuPont strains were originally red wine yeast. And so I decided to play around with the same idea, adjusted the malt bill just a little bit again, and if you ever go into your homebrew shop and they sell winemaking supplies, you know, they have the wine concentrate kits, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they usually have two varieties. They have like the nice big box ones where it's partially concentrated. And then they have these cans of Alexander grape concentrate. And they're exactly what they sound like. They're boiled grape must and have just been reduced down into a thick syrup. They make absolutely awful wine. I'm going to tell you that right now. Don't buy this to actually make wine. But you go and you add a can of that into a Saison, and now you have a Saison Vin that has a big grapey wine character to it. And then obviously if you're going to do wine and wine grapes, a little bit of oak. So I think the last one I did of that, I used a concentrate of Merlot, and then I soaked it on French oak cubes that had been soaking in Pinot Noir for 2 months.
So when did you add the must?
I added the must right as primary was starting to slow down.
Because if it's canned, you know, it's got to be at least sanitary and probably sterile, right?
Yeah, I mean, at that point in time, you can treat it like you treat honey. You know, honey is going to be sanitary coming out of the container. The primary job that you have to do is make sure that you can sanitize the container well enough that you're not going to pick up anything.
Cool.
Yeah, so there you go. Saisons, three ways.
Denny, your turn.
You know, this is a tough question for me. I'm not nearly as wacky as Drew is, at least in regard to adding things to beer. And because I take more of that like integrated approach, like I was talking about earlier, it's not like I have a beer style I check things into. I kind of think about results. I mean, it's like I love IPAs. There's not a whole lot of room, at least to my mind, of doing stuff, although I do love to make like an IPA with Y yeast 3522, the Ardennes yeast, and kind of give it that Belgian phenolic. Triples I absolutely love, and there are things you can do with those as long as you're not concerned about them remaining true to the triple style. In the book, there's a recipe for a triple where you add caramelized honey and white, green, and red peppercorns to it. That's a killer beer. I would say that probably if I had to pick a style that I've done more experimenting with than any other, it would probably be porter. I'm not a particularly big porter fan, but for some reason, when I start thinking about blending flavors, I go to the chocolatey flavor and body of a robust American porter, and you know, do things like you know, making it a rye porter. My bourbon vanilla imperial porter, if you were to leave the bourbon and vanilla out of that, it makes a great base for a coffee porter. I've made a blueberry porter, which was very interesting because blueberries are such a subtle flavor. They really, really melded with the porter well, but you had to use a lot of them.
Yeah, you would be afraid that if you didn't use enough, it would be perceived as a defect rather than
Yeah, right. I think that I used around 8 pounds, 8 or 9 pounds of blueberries in a 5-gallon batch, and still, it was one of those what is it things. That's a nice note, but I actually had to tell people it was blueberries before they could realize that. So.
Well, because I mean, I think most people aren't familiar with the taste of the fruits after they ferment out. Like blueberries become basically, you know, pepper.
Yeah.
Speaking of pepper, speaking of pepper, you have a when I saw you guys at Club Night, you were handing out recipe cards for your Pepper Pile Pale Ale, which not only has the hot peppers, but it also has peppercorns as well.
Well, people to think that this is that this beer is all about pepper and peppercorns. There's only two recipes, and we've now mentioned both of them.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, but and the idea isn't to like burn your face off. The idea is to enhance the beer flavor. Yeah. Or at least that's what we tell people.
Well, and like you know, so the. Part of the inspiration for Pepper Pile came from again the world of saisons, right? And when you when people didn't really have access to saison yeast, they didn't really understand how to drive them to get the right spice characters done out of it. At least here in California, the peppercorns were a fairly common addition, so that people were trying to get that same kind of pepperiness that you get out of the saison yeast. And I think for me, at least, I kind of got addicted to that. Because if you do like a really rough cracked black pepper, and you put it into the beer for about the first 2 weeks after the addition, it's really hot. It's that big big spicy pepperine character. After that tends to fade out, and what you get is this kind of deep and very hard to place earthiness instead of the heat.
So how do you balance the heat? You use jalapenos, right?
Yeah, but you use the red jalapenos.
So you let them mellow out a bit.
Yeah, so red jalapenos are always going to be more mild than green jalapenos. And then you have a fairly short contact time, and we also de-seed them. So, you know, with those kind of steps, mostly what you're going to get out of the jalapenos, you're going to get a little bit of kick. Not a lot, and it's not going to be the kind of kick that kind of builds, but you're going to get more of the kind of that pepper fruitiness, and then that will then play in with the Szechuan peppercorn, and yeah, I know, before people object, Szechuan peppercorn is not actually a pepper, it's a part of a citrus plant from China, thank you, but we call it a peppercorn, and that has a really kind of cool big citrusy flavor along with a heat and a neurotoxin type tingling in your tongue.
Yeah. it's a really cool effect. Your tongue goes numb. So I was going to say that while we're discussing wacky beers, I think that Drew is particularly proud of his bratwurst beer recipe that's in there. it's diabolical. And, you know, go ahead, Drew.
Well, yeah, so there's a beer that I've done in the past called Bratty Brat. And the whole idea was, I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, there was Buffalo Wild Wings had a commercial that showed two guys hanging out in the bar, and they were happy to be able to watch the game at the bar instead of their friend's house, their friend who was a home brewer. And, you know, they cut to this wacky guy who's sitting there, carboys everywhere in his living room with beers foaming over and whatnot. And he's pouring his friend's beers. And he's like, you know, this one has a secret ingredient. And the guy makes a disgusting face. And, oh, and this one's a bratwurst beer. And they cut to the beer and there's chunks of bratwurst floating in it and whatnot. And
I remember, you know, that.
There was kind of a thing of like, okay, well, that's kind of a dumb joke. And hey, look, we're a big enough hobby now that we're being made fun of on a national TV commercial. Yay!
Drew didn't realize that this was supposed to be a bad idea.
What I sat down and did said to myself was, you know, self, that's not the way a homebrewer would make a bratwurst beer. That's silly, silly national marketing people. And so I sat down and I thought, okay, well, what would a bratwurst beer be? And what I decided was, well, okay, obviously we're talking a German sausage. So let's do something German inspired. And so the idea was a little bit of kind of like a Hefeweizen. So the base is really a Hefeweizen spiced up with some rye. All right. So far fairly normal.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing way out there. Real light hopping to it to just, you know, give some bitterness, but, no overt hop character. I mean, again, we're back in the Hefeweizen territory. And then the real trick, the real magic, comes in spices. And the spices are all based on what you would find in a Nuremberg bratwurst. I'd like to apologize to the Wisconsin folks who may or may not be listening to it, but your bratwurst pretty much contains salt and pepper, and that's kind of boring.
He said that. Don't send me any email.
Yeah. Bob, I'll give Bob Stemsky your email address.
So the Nuremberg bratwurst contains allspice, black pepper, caraway, celery seed, clove, ginger, and nutmeg. And so the beer itself is constructed around those being last-minute additions to the boil kettle, so they have just enough time to soak into the beer. And then you ferment off with a neutral yeast. And the idea is that you should have a beer in your glass that smells like a bratwurst in terms of, you know, the spiciness and the spice profile, and has some kind of a rich and sweet roundish body, almost like a fat body like you'd expect out of a bratwurst. But at the same time, it's still, you know, it's a beer. And its primary job is to be a beer. But it's the whole thing, like, you know, if you look at like modernist cuisine where they talk about deconstruction, and this is a deconstructed bratwurst.
So no bratwursts were actually harmed in the creation of the beer.
No bratwursts were harmed in the creation. But I love telling people, yeah, I made a bratwurst beer, just to watch them, you know, mouth curl in horror, eyes crinkle up in fear, and like get this look on their face like they're about to go, you disgusting, disgusting man.
But of course, that doesn't mean that we don't have recipes in the book that are brewed with meat. We actually have three of them. We have a pork chop ale, a bacon Helles, and a modernized version of a cock ale.
So to speak.
You know, I wasn't going to go there, James. The standard joke is, I wish they would have told me they met a chicken. Yeah, right. But the pork soda recipe for a brown ale with pork chops is very interesting. I run an iron brewer competition for my club, and for years I had joked that I was going to make the secret ingredient pork chops. And although I never actually did, one guy in the club decided he would show me what a pork chop beer was like. And it was the best pork chop beer I've ever had.
So how do you deal with the fat? I mean, if you actually put a pork chop in there, there's, you know, pork tends to be a fatty meat, and it seems like the fat would destroy your head retention.
Well, you know, you'd think that, but he puts the pork chops in the mash, and it worked fine. By the time he got to the final product, the fat had, like, I assume he'd racked out from underneath it.
You heard it here first, folks. More than likely, barley husks will soak up fat.
Oh,
it's America's new diet for dietary health.
Yeah. I'm wearing some right now.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, the ingredients he used for this were pork chops, grains of paradise, ground sage, black peppercorns, and then more ground sage. He dry saged it.
So we should say that not every recipe in this book is as off the wall. That, you know, there's normal stuff in here, too. It's just not as fun to talk about the normal stuff.
That is exactly right. And especially in the chapter of the book where we're talking about our favorite experimental styles, we start with the straight ahead recipes for that style and then start talking about how to change them. The chapter on recipe design has some pretty darn good straight ahead recipes. So yeah, not everything has to have meat or peppers in it.
Although I would argue that, you know, one thing I did learn when I was writing the cider book, when I wrote just before this one, is that meat does have a very long place in the fermentation sciences. Used to be that before they understood the idea about yeast nutrients and all that sort of, for that matter, before they understood about yeast, the brewers and cider makers had figured out that sometimes if their beer and cider wasn't finishing out and wasn't clearing, that they could go and stick a side of pork into the vessel, and it would help finish the beer or cider out. And you know, nowadays we know that what they were actually doing is they were adding amino acid chains to the free amino nitrogen to the must, and that was allowing the yeast to go, oh, okay, I can do my job now. But you know, go throw a pork shoulder into the beer. That's what you had to do.
That's a terrible waste of pork.
Well, I want to know what possessed the first guy to think of that.
Probably he was the same guy who thought about eating an oyster.
The guy who ate the oyster was hungry. The guy who thought about throwing the pork shoulder in the beer was probably thirsty.
he was drunk when he did it.
He was walking on the catwalk above the fermenter and dropped the piece of meat in there accidentally.
And then didn't want to tell his boss.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell anybody. And hey, this beer's clear. Now, chapter 10 is experiments, and it's experiments in the mash and the boil and the fermenter, and through all of the stages of the brewing process, you have experiments. And as I understand it, did I read in there where you want this to be an interactive experience and get some feedback from the readers?
Yeah, absolutely.
Very much so. That's the whole idea, because we're not telling people how to brew. It's very important that they relate their own experiences so that other people can try things and see what works for them. So we've set up a website, experimentalbrew.com, where people can go and report the results of the experiments they do and talk about them and give people ideas for experiments they can do themselves. Also, this was the section of the book that had some of the biggest cuts in it. So we're going to be having a lot of additional suggestions for experiments available on the website. And we want it to be extremely interactive with people talking about what they're doing and why, and other people trying it and telling how it worked for them.
Yeah. I mean, you think of it this way, you know, kind of going back to the citizen science bit, you know, we don't, none of us, even, you know, even those of us who have the snazziest equipment in the entire universe with, you know, fancy computer controls everywhere, we don't have the industrial process controls in place for all of our brewing process to really be sort of repeatable in our results on all this sort of stuff, at least not to any sort of degree of scientific accuracy. And so one of the things that you can depend upon with a citizen science movement is that if we have, yeah, I'm doing an experiment, Denny's doing the experiment, you're doing the experiment, and 20 other people are doing the experiment, and we see that 17 of the people got this result, and the other handful got the opposite result, you can start to get a level of confidence in what we're actually, in what's being proposed. And you can also look and see and go, okay, why did they get a different result than we did? What's different in that whole process? And get there and actually figure something out.
Yeah, with our a series of collaborative experiments that we've done on the podcast in the past, we've seen that, you know, where you're not going to get 100% everybody on the same page, but if you can see some general trends, then you can at least form some sort of opinion on some distinctions to draw in the whole thing.
Yeah. Right. And as we pointed out early in the book, we're not trying to cure cancer. This is home brewing. So close enough is good enough. You know, if you see a number of people all getting the same results from a particular ingredient or technique, you can probably figure that it's likely you'll get that result too. And that gives you some confidence in starting to do your own experiments.
Yeah. Although now that Denny has said that, I can guarantee you that in 5 years we'll have a news headline. Breaking, scientists discover homebrew cures cancer.
Works for me. I'll live forever then.
So how do we get the book and when?
The book right now is available either from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or our publisher's website. And if you go to experimentalbrew.com, we have a link at the top where you can order a book from any of those sources that you prefer. They told us that it will be out by November, although it's looking like they may show up in the warehouse a little bit early. I don't want to give anybody any false hope. The other thing, too, for people who want to get an autographed book and can't make it to one of the various signings we're going to be doing, we have book plates. If you buy a book and contact us, we'll autograph one of these book plates and you can stick it inside your book and it'll look just like we signed it for you.
Cool.
Yeah, and remember, that's November, the perfect time to buy a Christmas gift for the homebrewer.
That's right. Or several, you know, one for a gift, one for yourself, one as a backup for when you spill beer on the other one.
Yeah, you need your library copy, you need your brewery copy, you need one for work.
In the car.
Yeah. And speaking of in the car, as far as we know, this will also be available on electronic media. I'm not sure of the schedule for that, but we'll find out and put it on the website.
Awesome.
The other thing, I guess, that is pretty darn exciting about it that we just found out, we just got confirmation on today, is that John Meyer at Rogue will be brewing one of the recipes in the book for commercial distribution.
Oh, wow.
We don't know which one yet. We gotta work all this out, you know. But John wrote us a blurb for the back cover saying that he was going to try some of these things in his brewery. So we decided to ask him to do it, and he agreed.
We decided we might as well be there too.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah. So Drew and I will be going to Rogue to brew one of these recipes with John, and hopefully it'll be available for everybody in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, see, this is one of the advantages of, you know, Denny knows John very well because, you know, they're both in Oregon, and Oregon only really has 10 people.
he's in our homebrew club.
Well, and then simultaneously, John is an old-time member of my club. That's where he got started, so we all have a connection.
Rogue has been known to produce some kind of wacky beers, so we figured he was a good guy to hit up. It'll be a lot of fun.
The homebrew family tree has no forks.
Yeah, there you go.
It's all spoons.
Well, this is in addition to being an interesting and useful book, it is also very fun to look at. It's beautiful. The photography is very nice, and I just have an electronic version myself right now, but I'm looking forward to my hard copy soon.
Yes, so are we, James. So are we.
Yeah, and I would love to take credit for how well the book looks, but truthfully, that comes down to our editor, who did such a great job of setting things up. I mean, the most input that we ended up giving them was, you know, mad science fiction, and if you're going to do this beer, let's have it with a goat if we can. And we actually have
yeah,
a goat
that's right.
in the book.
I know. How many brewing books do you know that have pictures of goats? What does that say?
I saw the goat. I didn't see, you know, usually like on the cereal box, if they're going to have like bananas in the cereal, they'll say serving suggestion down below. I didn't notice whether that caption was on there or not.
Serving suggestion. One goat.
I guess we missed that. And there are pictures of my actual brewing system in my actual garage. So if people want to see exactly how low tech I am and laugh at me, they have that opportunity.
We're on the same wavelength, I think.
Yeah.
Well, awesome, guys. I appreciate it very much, and good luck. I hope it sells a bunch.
Why, thank you, James. It's been great talking to you as always.
Absolutely. It's been fun.
Well, thanks again to Drew and Denny. It is a well-produced book. Very nice. I got a preview hard copy today, in fact. And it's very nice. I can't wait to dog-ear it and do some of the recipes and the experiments in there. And I like the fact that we can do the experiments in Chapter 10 and report our results online. And we'll have to have Drew and Denny back to let us know how those experiments are shaping up after people have had a chance to input their data. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You'll find our bottle openers on our shop. Our Basic Brewing growler bags are also available. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beers. You take it from place to place. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site, along with combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, with a free bottle opener included with every DVD combo for a limited time. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. Our Brewer's Logbooks are on the store, too. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there greatly. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Turn Left at Orion, 100 Night Sky Objects to See in a Small Telescope and How to Find Them, and 36-inch, 24-color, changing LED hula hoop. Cotton candy rainbow. Very cool. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dots. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.